So the first question I wanted to ask you was, how did you start getting involved in the housing issue, and how did you, what was your kind of first experiences with homelessness?
Back in the, I guess it was about 2001. I've only been in Vancouver since 1998, September. And because we do have deal with many people that were homeless on our food line, in our clothing room, and in with families that have had problems feeding their children, we have a sort of care packages for them. And joining a whole group of Vancouver urban core workers represent many of the agencies in the area doing work one type of another. And a group that was represented there from the Downtown East Side Residents Association that manages three buildings of social housing invited me to be on their board. So I accept that because knowing how many of the men that use our soup line, and that now is between 500 and 600, 5 days a week, I thought, well, to be involved someplace where there's housing might give us an opportunity to suggest some of these people that are homeless or in a really inadequate, some of these single room occupancies that have no bathroom of their own and no kitchen facilities, which makes life very, very difficult for them. So I thought, this I'd want to put some of my time and life into that. And for a series of different reasons, the former board was in a relationship with someone else that was promising to build social housing and could get, because of being associated with DERA, could get the government to be subsidizing the apartments they were fixing up in these old buildings. But that group went bankrupt. So any of the involvement that DERA had with that building was also lost. So the board was told to resign, and the executive director, and for some of the things that they had borrowed money without the board's knowledge, really, so all of them and the leadership of the board, the president, the vice president, the treasurer, the secretary, and the executive director all let go. And only on the condition that they would leave would they continue to fund DERA. So the support for those three buildings and the ability to keep people on very low incomes in those buildings depended on BC Housing giving the support. If they withdrew that, it'd just go out. So I was asked, I wasn't present when that happened, I was in New York. And when I got back, I was asked if I would be chairperson of the board. And since then, and because we do have, funded by the Law Foundation, three advocates and a receptionist for their service that are trained in advocacy, we're able to really not only serve our people, but all the people that come in the door looking for housing, or if they're being treated unjustly by the manager or the whatever building they're living in, and try to put them out without giving them adequate notice or without having an adequate reason. For instance, back last September, one of the houses, one of the buildings in the neighborhood, the landlord gave them a notice that they were to be out, I think, within 2 weeks, or certainly by the end of the month, because he needed to do renovations and get the bed bug problem and the rats and roaches taken care of. And then after a couple of months, when that was all done, they could come back in. However, to be able to do that, first of all, he would have had to give them 2 months' notice. And the second one is he would have had to have a permit from the city to do any kind of renovation. He had neither, because giving them such short notice. And I guess earlier in the year, he had let it be known to somebody that he was going to empty his building and get it all prepared for the Olympics. Well, immediately the advocate that heard this problem from the person that came told the executive director, who called the city immediately and asked if this person had a permit, and explained that this is what he was going to do, which would have affected 80 units of housing. And their response was, he doesn't have a permit. And what he's talking about, he doesn't need to do renovation. He doesn't need to empty the building. So by that Friday, the city inspectors came and went with our executive director, pointed out to the manager what they needed to do. So that was saving 80 units of social housing. So, you know, being able to do that. And then some people that haven't got their welfare check or their assistance or their rent or whatever. And sometimes it's a matter of clerical mistake or whatever. But to have somebody go, have an advocate go with them to really understand that this is what the situation is, and if they don't get it paid immediately, they'll be homeless. So it's really serving in whatever way we can, certainly to save the people in our apartments, but also to save people in the neighborhood who have one or another kind of... And of course, there are many people that are have problems with addictions or with mental illness or even with medical problems where, for whatever reason, they're denied the kind of care they should be getting. And sometimes you have an advocate call them, and that's all you need to do to... But without the advocates, I just felt it's a really wonderful extension of meeting people who are on the lowest level of income, or whether it's assistance or whatever. And actually, the assistance level is so low now that the little bit of money that they have left after the $375 is taken out for their rent, they only get $510 or $60, whatever the amount is. You don't have much left. So it's, I'm glad to be able to be of some, play some part in relieving the lives of others. So.
That brings up another question: is what caused, why did you come to Vancouver, and why did you choose specifically, I guess, this?
I have worked always where there's a poor very poor. As a Franciscan, that's what we do: work wherever there's a poor population. And I had worked in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, in a very poor area, for 35 years. And then a few years after that, and I was involved in daycare for many years and realized how critical is the care of youngsters from birth until they're about 6 or 7. Because if they don't have the kind of loving care and support that parents can give them, they can be so badly affected. By the time they go to first grade, they are not able to listen. Without being anxious about maybe they're going to lose their home, maybe they won't, maybe they've already been moved from one place to another because the parents couldn't pay rent, or if the parents are on low income, how to manage. And of course, it causes a lot of friction in the home when it's, when it's causing so many problems. I've had a 4-year-old that said, if only I were died, everybody'd be happy, because he heard about all these family fights going on. I mean, they have ears to hear. And if that is the anxiety and fear and everything, because they're so young, everything applies to them. So no matter whether they understand what the fight is about or not, they think it's their fault. So if that is all in their mind, they're not open to hearing what they should be hearing as a part of entering life and being prepared for education and how it will improve their life, how it will contribute to their living. So, you know, that is part of, you know, what told me how important where they live or having a home to live in, feeling a sense of security, not having their parents under such terrible stress that they almost can't talk with the child enough to give them a sense of security, and knowing, seeing the results of that. So when I came here and could be in housing, and the reason I came here, I was called as part of our religious community. We have sisters in different places, even in Brazil and Japan and Ireland and Italy. And for whatever work is going on, we need staffing it. And it just happened that the sister that was here as the administrator had developed cancer. And when it was obvious that she was not going to be recovering, I was asked if I'd come up and do an evaluation on the program that was up here. So as soon as I got back, they called and asked me what I thought of it. And I thought, I was saying, it is such a wonderful service to those who have nothing that I thought it was the most admirable thing anybody could do. So then they asked if I'd like to come up and be the administrator. I had no reason not to. So that's how I got here. But you aren't sent to somebody, you're asked. And that's why I was asked to evaluate. I'd been asked to evaluate other programs, so I sort of knew what I was looking for. But realizing that many of those on our line, even the young ones, something happened when they were little. Something disturbed their life to the point that they turned to addiction, so they turned to whatever, and ran away from home when they were 10 or 12. So it's, now I see the end result. And it doesn't need to be that way. We'd really care for families. So that's why I'm happy to be here. I can at least do something. So.
Excuse me. What do you have, I should ask before anything else, do you have any very, I guess, memorable experiences with homelessness and around housing that particularly stick out that you'd like to share?
I was working on another organization called Community Directions, and there was a man, I think he was from El Salvador or Nicaragua or whatever. And he was a very effective person on this group and really was very faithful. He was part of our steering committee. And they got a group going for the Hispanics in the neighborhood, which were many, and had a lot of problems getting housing. And in the past year, I meet him on this. He's in one of these electrical chairs. And I got a call from him, and he was telling me that his daughter had been married and had I think the child is about a year, year and a half old, and that her husband, I don't know whether he abandoned her or divorced her or whatever, and of course with the child she wasn't able to work. But he just takes off. She can't pay her rent, so she loses the apartment. And the only thing she can do is go live with her mother. I guess this is Rodolfo's niece. Anyway, so they moved into, I guess it's a two-bedroom apartment. There are already five people in that apartment. She's sleeping on her mother's couch. and I don't know where the little one is sleeping. But anyway, she has found a job, so it's her mother's taking care of the baby during the day. But it's, you know, she works at different hours. And Tori Delphi was telling me she just really... So I suggested that she call me so that I could give her the information. In the meantime, I called the director of DERA and asked if there was any possibility that this was an emergency for a mother that's really homeless with a very small child. And the answer I got was that there is one apartment in a building that has families, that has women and children. Most of the others just have singles. And that the woman that's in there is going into, I don't know whether it's long-term care or into a nursing home or whatever, but that by the time she has moved out and the painting and cleaning up of that apartment, preparing it for next, wouldn't be till April 1st. So in the meantime, there was nothing immediate, you know, that she could be moved into. With a child, she should have a two-bedroom. But this is only a one-bedroom, but it's an emergency. So, and then if a two-bedroom becomes available at some time, then she'd be the first to be able to have it. But anyway, to me, that was such a relief that here you have a small child with its mother put into a very, very unsatisfactory position, not room enough to live in. So to be able to be in a position to, you know, my job isn't to order anything, but to at least inquire and say, this is someone that can put in an application and be, you know, housed. That to me is a thrilling part of knowing, you know, how to meet an emergency need, and especially because it involves a small child.
So you seem to put a lot of emphasis on the children and how important it is to have a kind of a stable childhood.
Yes.
And you related it to homelessness earlier. Do you want to maybe expand on that?
Yes. One of the things that I sometimes, we have about 200 volunteers because we have to have about 10 or 12 make between 1,000 and 1,500 sandwiches every day to prepare for the soup line. And sometimes we have high schools asking if some of their students that need to do some community work or to do social service or whatever, as an experience that there really are poor people, because some of these are private schools that these kids think everybody lives the way they do. So I would usually go down and talk to them and say, you know, the sandwiches you're making, the person that gets them may not be as old as you are. And the reason might be whatever happened to them when they were very little made them feel that their education wasn't worth it. They just wanted to escape from whatever, either their physical or emotional punishment or violence in the home or whatever the problem was. They may have been out on the street when they were 10 or 12. And then I say to them, remember, no matter how boring you think school is or how hard your homework is or how hard it is with putting up with the teachers or the other students or whatever, remember, your education is going to be what stands between yourself and the quality of life that you want to live. So take your education seriously. You don't want to be out there standing in line for food because you don't have any place to live. So it's... to me, and it has been, you know, forever, the realization that education is any individual's key to the quality of life that they want. So I don't know if that answers the question.
That's great. Yeah. I was so in terms of advocacy, could you touch upon the kind of political landscape there is around housing, and for example, like who is, I guess, kind of friendly to the idea? Is like, what is it, mostly municipal government, or is it also provincial? Or who, the question would be like, kind of, who's kind of doing the right thing in your mind, and who's kind of advocating for the.
My understanding, I didn't come here until 98. But my understanding was that back in 92 or 93, in Ottawa, there had been this whole big meeting of corporate heads and developers and other people who are making the decisions for the country. Unfortunately, politicians listen to them and forget they are elected by the people for the people. But because these big things claim how much taxes they're paying and how many jobs they're going to be giving out, they don't say how little they pay their employees, but in any case, they are listened to. And one of the complaints that they had was that as long as the government was into building social housing, the government was interfering with private enterprise. For whatever reason, the person in charge of the budget at the time thought to themselves, oh, good, we don't have to divide up the funds for housing to each of the provinces, so we can put that money elsewhere. What these developers were talking about wasn't the fact that the government is interfering with private enterprise. The government would be paying the people, the construction engineers and all the architects and everything else, the same as a developer would. The one thing that would be left out is the amount of profit for the developer. So, you know, not to realize that what the families need, especially low-income families need, is affordable homes to raise their children. And once that fund from the national level dried up, eventually provinces tightened up. But certainly from the time I've gotten here, we haven't gotten more social housing. And one of the more recent terrible disappointments, as far as I was concerned, was the False Creek housing that was built and initially used for the Olympic Village. After 12 years of planning with the neighborhood and between the city and, I guess, developers, whatever, the plan was to have 30% of all of these units be for market rate housing, which is the highest rate, 30% be for the moderate income, and 30% for social housing. And I guess that had been passed. Was about to be passed. And anyway, when Mayor Sullivan wasn't in office a month, when he came up with this resolution that arrangement would not pay the city enough money for the value of its property. However, they did propose a huge sum for that. More, I guess, than the city even asked. However, but he thought to increase the profits that they changed the designation from the 30% for the three rates to 80% for market rate, the highest, and that 20% go for moderate income. 20% for people who earn $60,000 to $100,000 a year, which leaves out everybody below.
No more.
So, and there were 59 of us that when we were up there until, I think it was nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, saying, don't do this, don't vote for this, because it takes away the one piece of social housing that had been planned on for over 12 years. One person said, well, because there is, I don't know how many hundred million of money that has been set aside from developing the market rate stuff around the city that is supposed to be used for social housing. And this woman got up, came in at the last minute, and I think she was called by one of the counselors, and said, the worst financial steps to take is to take money from the principal instead of just using the interest that you get every year. It was such a stupid argument. And yet, the bill was passed. 6-5. No matter how many of the people who work with housing, who know the desperate need for affordable housing, had their voices heard. So, actually, as of now, because we've had so much, and of course, the province bought, just before the Olympics, bought all these old hotels. It wasn't adding any amount of social housing. It was buying buildings at a very high price that they weren't worth. And some of them are dumps to begin with and still need a lot of renovation just to make them somewhat human. But without a bathroom and a kitchen, it's not human, really. Can't be considered a home. But, you know, in any case, that's not increasing the amount of affordable housing for the people that need it. And my kick, because of my concern for children and the effect of bad housing on children or no housing, you know, is just we're pushing now for a national housing plan so that, because the city obviously doesn't have the money to go for housing. And the provinces have some that they could, if they wanted to, use for housing. And of course, that's what they claim they did with buying all these buildings. But that's a political move. It's allowing developers to continue to profit on dumps. So that, and one of the groups is Pivot, which is a legal service for the poor, and pushing for this social housing because it's, you know, now across Canada, well, of course, the United States too, but, and I've heard for somebody that was working with the state's plan, and Portland, Oregon decreased their homelessness by 70% by building social housing and putting into it the way of dealing with the supportive services like for the addicted and for the mentally ill and for people who are sick and have problems taking care of their own apartments. And we have that, but we don't have any supportive services to do it. We try to do it with whatever staff we have. But again, I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, no, it's excellent. So I would then get you to expand on, so, well, have you, like, has the federal government been at all responsive to your call for a national housing plan?
That has really started this past year since, you know, there was no real response for making a decision. Come on, get this going, get money for social housing, get it started, get it going. We have up until, well, they just had a count done yesterday or the day before, Tuesday.
Yesterday.
Maybe it was Tuesday they did the housing, the count on the homelessness. But as of last year, it was like 2,000 on the streets considered homeless. And of course, even if they have shelters, which Mayor Robertson was good about getting shelters opened, but they will be closing March 31st. Now the Olympics are open, so... You know, let them go out on the street again. But it's, you know, it just is unconscionable that the people at the highest political level don't seem to hear that what their job is as elected officials is to care for the people who elected them, not the ones that paid for their campaigns to be successful, so that they can, again, the next term around, again, get these people to... Because it's not the corporations that vote for them. It is the little people. And they should be, when we say we are a democracy and we have a government that is voted for by the people, and they should be working for the people. So when you have thousands, I think the number is over 300,000 across the country, or I think it's even much more than that. But even in BC, we have a huge problem. I've heard from people in New Westminster, out in Port Coquitlam, out in, you know, even Maple Ridge has their own, which is, you know, pretty upper income community, but they have their homeless too. People can't pay their rent or whatever the problem is, they're out. So that's all I have to say on that.
How did your faith influence why you wanted to work with the impoverished?
What I say when we have a sit-down hot meal from between 800 to 900 people, different parish puts it on. And one of the things that I say to them after I say grace, I say, remember who you are. When you leave here, you might take your empty coffee cup or the banana peels or whatever. Be sure you remember who you are. You are the image of God. God created all of us equal, and that is your highest dignity. And your dignity requires that you live in as neat and clean a neighborhood as possible. So by your putting that trash in a trash bin, you are doing your bit to keep the neighborhood as clean as possible so that your dignity and the dignity of your neighbor will be recognized. So it's a way of telling them, and that's what my mother taught me, is we are all created equally in the image of God. So you treat every person with equal dignity, and that whatever you can do that will make life easier for them, you do. There's no excuse for not really respecting everyone.
So it's a moral imperative.
Yeah. So, and that's why I guess when I experienced our sisters when I was a kid in camp, their attitude toward everyone, all of us, was like they took us seriously. And I told my mother when I came home from camp, that's what I'm going to be when I grow up. Because I found out that other women, you know, that were met, like, you weren't, I mean, they were good to their own kids and everything, but I was just a kid and not taken seriously. But they would go for walks with us and talk with us like we had something to say. So I was sort of awed by them at first, but... You know, and so that was their attitude toward me that I, you know, and of course my mother was the first one. We couldn't say anything, you know, if we say, oh, you know what so-and-so did? No, I don't want to know. You can't say something good about somebody. I don't want to hear it. I mean, that can be dangerous because sometimes, but in those days we didn't have predators, we didn't have drugs, we didn't have, you know, there was nobody that we had to fear. So we had to treat everybody with dignity. And either we called them Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, or uncle or aunt. We just didn't call them by their first name. But, again, that was our parents' way of making sure that we lived up to our dignity and that we couldn't ever hurt anybody. So that was just absolutely, because as we're loved by God, they are loved by God too. So you hurt them, you're hurting somebody God loves very much. So when we'd fight, my mother, let's, you know, that's it. You don't, you go upstairs, you stay here, and just separate us. Think about it. So, but it's sad because my working life, I've come across so many people that were at such odds with each other and treated each other with, oh, just such terrible disrespect. I just can't imagine, you know, having to live with life being very angry at somebody. And of course, anger is very destructive. It doesn't hurt the other person unless you hit them, of course. But if you stay angry and don't forgive, I mean, even the Our Father says, forgive me as I forgive others. But it is, it just eats away at your spirit. So because I'm 86, I've had a lot of reason to understand that. In fact, I was fired from a daycare center that I had founded and started and ran, and we really would be, I'd be really working with the teachers that if a child was seen to having a problem, that we'd get whatever help they needed. And back in those days, they didn't do an evaluation of children unless they were six. And I'd go pushing around to hospitals that this is a child that's sick, he needs help. It might be psychological, it might be whatever. Until I found something, or an agency that would deal with kids that were 3 years old and showing very great, you know, signs of that something was wrong. And as the one I said, when he was 4 years old, saying that he was exhibiting very anxious behavior in school, like if it's time to go out to the park or something, he'd hold on to the table so he wouldn't move. Well, you can't leave a child alone in a classroom, and you can't leave one teacher and have one teacher go out with 20 kids. So I said, call me and I'll go and deal with them. So we finally got, a friend of mine, ours was a psychologist, and he came in and just observed the child one day. He said, he's a very unhappy child, he's probably psychotic. I said, well, should he be hospitalized? And he said, no. So then they had a family meeting and all that, and had everybody in the family come. And I was out because we had a sister that was a social worker working with them. And I was outside, so Tommy came out of where the psychologist was dealing with all of the family. And he said, when they talk in there, it hurts my head so much, I can't stand it. He's the one that said, if I were only dead. He committed suicide when he was 14. Hung himself in his own living room. His mother was across the street playing cards with cousins. And his father, his older brother, his father had died. And I do think that had a lot to do with his increased depression and his sense. And one of his problems seemed to be he was extremely bright. Like we had gotten him enrolled in a what we called the I Spy in the hospital, which was a psychiatric service for children. And while he was in daycare, he went faithfully, and I think when he first started in school. And our sister, Paul Joseph, who was our social worker, arranged when it was, you know, time to go to school with the sister that was the teacher in the Holy Redeemer School that was right across from their apartment. And the parents were, you know, sending him there. She arranged, sister, they had a very low frustration tolerance. So they met with the mother and Tommy and the principal of the school, and or the teacher of the first grade, and the social worker explained Tommy's problem with frustration. So she said, Tommy, I'll put you in the seat right in front of my desk, and you give me a sign that when you're not feeling good, just give me a sign, and I will call you and say, I have a note that I have to get to the principal's office. Would you just take this note? And then, don't go to the principal's office. Go into the bathroom, wash your face, jump up and down. Don't make any noise. Jump up and down. And then when you feel better, come back into the classroom and give me the note back. So it worked out fine. When he was about in fourth grade, I happened to meet the parents on the street. They said, come on in and have a cup of tea. So I went in. And so after we talked about what the father's job was, actually what the father was doing was working on the World Trade Center, the building of it. And so I said, well, how's Tommy doing with his therapist? And they said, oh, he hasn't been there in a long time. There's nothing wrong with his head. He has like eighth grade reading and sixth grade history or science. It's all so far above. I said, it's not his head. It's how he feels about it. He had no friends. The only friends he had were like an elderly man next door that used to come out and sit on the stoop. And he'd go and sit with him and talk with him. I think he was sort of afraid of children, but there was so much family turmoil. But I think he knew his father was really not part of it. It was a poor combination. They loved each other, but the mother was the only daughter of an older Italian family. And of course, nobody'd ever be good enough for their Rosie. And Larry was the youngest son of a big, raucous Irish family. But, he was such a nice guy. And she was so timid. And so you could see how she was drawn to him because he looked so secure and strong and protective. But her mother hated Larry. And that's what, and they lived upstairs and Larry in the... So it was that kind of constant fight that just destroyed this poor little kid. And his father died 2 years before of lung cancer, a heavy smoker. And so it's, when you see how things develop, and this kid, and he was so bright, he got a scholarship to a good boys high school, LaSalle Academy. He was, as a sophomore, he was tutoring the kids that were juniors and seniors in math. He was just brilliant. But none of that makes a place for security, and they did live in a tiny, tiny little apartment. So it was... Anyway, those are my experiences with...
That's excellent. And last thing I'll ask you is there anything else you want to share while I have you?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you how deeply affected are our futures when we don't pay attention to what's happening to the children in our society. We are neglecting what the future will hold. Because another aspect of one of the things that I always wanted to have in daycare, to have an after-school program, you work so hard to have them prepared to go to school. They go to first grade, they're 6 years old, and there's no care for them after school. They're going to go home to an empty apartment, and they get to be 7 or 8? No. They're going to go out and find out the other kids that are hanging around that maybe don't have as much care as they should have. So they're attracted to the lowest level. And after school care back then would cost like between $3,000 and $5,000 a year. They get into trouble or run away from school or home or whatever. They get into juvenile detention, it costs like $40,000 a year. Can't the public see that just even there, it's not only what the terrible things, the quality of life that happens to the child or the direction they're going in, but it's also costing society what could be put into what is productive, not counterproductive. Anyway, I've had a great opportunity to learn, and I appreciate the opportunity to share that with others, because I'm constantly, as long as I live, I will be pleading for paying attention to the youngest in our society. They're our future.